Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, May the 12th, 2025. Joining me in studio today,
Peter R.H.
and Stephen Fan.
And I am Magnus Thiebold. We're happy to be here with you and glad you are out there at home listening to us. Wouldn't be much point for us to be here if you weren't there yourself. So thank you for that. We got some interesting stories. We got a story from Jesse Wentzloff about Red Dress Day at SFU. We also have a story about the value of balcony gardening for pollinators. As you may know, well, pollination is really important to the whole plant ecosystem, particularly in urban areas where there's a lot less foliage. What are you going to talk about today, Peter?
Mark Carney was involved. It starts with a B. What's that company was involved with? Brookfield or something?
Investment banking firm.
No, but it was Brookfield, I think.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Ezra Levant went to Bermuda to check out the office that was supposedly there for it. Mm-hmm. And the Iowa, what's on the video is him going there. He said it was too expensive to stay overnight, so he got a two-way thing for the same day. But it was sort of interesting that he was, it was above a bicycle top. It was sort of a bit of an office. It was sort of interesting. He went to the Iowa Man earlier for one of their little offices that supposedly wasn't there either. But I'm also going to be a bit critical of something else with Revel News. But it was sort of interesting. Canada Land did something that was they didn't go to Bermuda or anything, but they did a little – I think it was broadcast on the stage because we get Canada Land. But they yep. – it's a bit convoluted about he has options of shares or whatever. But anyway, so I'll be talking a bit about that. And I'll be critical – don't worry. I got something critical about Ezra Levant for everybody.
All right.
Coming up.
Okay. Hey, Stephen.
Oh, yeah, good morning. But, like, I think, you know, obviously the big news over the weekend is the decrease in tariffs between the United States and China that was announced, I think, midnight Western West Coast time last night. And they're now going from 145% on the U.S. side to 30% on China, and then from 125% on the Chinese side down to 10%, so 115% decrease on each side.
Although you got to keep in mind that that doesn't even take it back to where it was before Trump started this war. This is like Trump creating a problem and then going, look, I undid the problem.
I think China actually had the power to get it down to 10% if they wanted to. I don't think they necessarily want to, because a world in which there's 10% on everyone else and 30% on China, it's better for China than 10% on China and 0% on everyone else.
Right.
Because it just means that, you know, the United States is getting really kind of secluded from the global supply chains, and to some extent...
Well, it's not good strategy to start a trade war with everybody all at once, any more than it's a good strategy to start a war with all of your neighbors all at once.
I think there's the issue of essentially... There are various national security hawks in the U.S. administration who consider this a golden opportunity to, quote-unquote, counter China. But the reality is that Trump just likes tariffs. There's no grand strategic calculus. He just really loves tariffs. He's the tariff man. So I don't know.
I think one thing we've seen is that pretty much all this policy is just whatever it is Trump thinks. And whoever
it's like the Alcatraz thing. You know, he sees a movie and he wants to reopen Alcatraz.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And so that's sort of the world we live in now, whatever Trump's whims are. I mean, most of these policies go against everything that has been, I wouldn't even say it's Republican directions, you know, the whole sort of consensus of, you know, leaderships around the world around reducing tariffs and stuff, you know.
I think the United States has been, for the most part, a true beneficiary in the increasing mm-hmm. global trade and reduction in tariffs. And, you know, to some extent, people have talked about the sweatshop conditions that exist in third world countries. But for the most part, I'm not saying every single instance, for the most part, the United States has benefited.
Right.
Obviously, there are cases like auto plants shutting down in Youngstown, Ohio, or whatever. But also, you kind of have to admit that even before this happened, there were jokes about how you wouldn't want to buy a car made in the Midwest that's made on a Monday in the hunting season, because people would be like still like 3 years, like three beers in, completely buzzed from like the weekend shooting. So that was the world like the United States inhabited in the 1970s, and it's kind of hard to picture that now. I think the real question, I think, is what's going to happen with the U.S.-China relationship, because it's clearly very discretionary. It's very kind of it's kind of up in the air. But I think it would be really interesting, and this is something people have talked about a lot, people who are professionals, is the potential for U.S. and China to do a deal around where the U.S. will relax tariffs and China will invest in the United States with stuff like BYD plants and, you know, like battery plants and solar plants and stuff like that. And that would actually be very mutually beneficial. So we'll see.
Well, there's something that I just saw on my tablet, a YouTube posting. He supposedly, I don't know if this is as new as today, but he wants to take prescription drugs down up to like 80% and so on. But what on the posting that I saw, what the person was saying, that this could be struck down quite easily in the Senate or the House.
It's strictly ultra vires. It's outside his constitutional powers. But I don't.
Also, what tools is he going to use to do that?
But like, I think
can't just do an edict and tell companies where to set their prices.
But
right?
here's my kind of take on this. I'm not too worried about the legal side. I don't think he's going to get anything done on the legal side. I think the thing that's intriguing to me is that prescription drug prices are too high in the United States, as it is anywhere else, but they exist in an ecosystem whereby the United States pharmaceutical market is literally 50% of the worldwide pharmaceutical market by dollar value.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that every dollar that the United States gets taken out of its pharmaceutical market in an attempt to reach price parity with other countries where it's cheaper, like Canada or Netherlands or whatever, is ultimately just a $1 less going into the market. And there is some waste, there's some corruption in the market, in the sense that a lot of the fundamental research are funded by the National Institutes of Health, and pharmaceutical companies are not necessarily necessary to the operation. But ultimately, it's the drug discoveries we have are because there's an economic model there. The United States trying, and this is also why, so Bernie Sanders trying to re-import drugs from Canada, that was never going to work. Canada's not going to allow it, but also the economics is going to just blow up on its face.
Well, if I could just add, what they said in the posting was, one of the things they were saying was a bit, he was disingenuous, Trump, with it, was because he's not going to cooperate with Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. Suppose Bernie Sanders said, well, cooperate with us and we'll get it through. So they were saying he's just doing a virtual signal. Well, I tried and I'm so concerned. I mean,
and I suspect that's more the case. You know, I think this is just a good news distraction from the fact that even with the change in, you know, tariffs to China, you know, the big drop in trade volume, even for a month, and the disruption to supply chains and stuff, it's going to come up with a big negative impact. I mean, we're looking, you might remember when that ship got stuck in the Suez Canal and blocked passage through there, and it created all these knock-on effects through the world economy by blocking this major trade route for whatever it was, a week and a half or something like that. You know, already, you know, West Coast ports are seeing huge drop-offs in the flow of goods from China, and that might start coming
back.
But that's going to take a month or more to play out, not to mention the fact that you know, a lot of companies rush bought stuff before the tariffs went in. So now they got stock, but they're not going to buy stuff.
There's going to be
a lot of companies
buying.
Stopped. You know, they didn't order stuff because they didn't know how much it was going to cost, or they knew it was uneconomic, not knowing when these, how long these tariffs would last, and whether they're going to go back up again. So we're about to see the impact of that, you know, in the economy. And it's important to remember, a lot of that impacts the consumer side of the economy, and the consumer economy is what really drives the American economy.
Absolutely. It's a consumer-driven economy, and it's driven by consumer finance, housing finance. And I think if you look at what's happening with the trade, for example, there's a prediction, well, there's expectation, really, that there will be a massive surge in inventories right now because of the lower tariffs. People are trying to get in front of Christmas. People don't know what's going to happen with the tariffs in 3 months or 4 months or 5 months. So they're desperately trying to get whatever they can get their hands on from China in time for Christmas. That's the big rush. So there's going to be a huge boom in orders, if any, which is ironic. But I think, you know, like, yeah, like it's rough. And I think the overall economy, it just has all these external disruptions. But, you know, like I would say, obviously Trump is never going to do this. But if you want to improve healthcare costs, pharmaceutical costs in the United States, what the government should be doing is more directly funding research, bypassing, you know, all like the billion-dollar marketing budgets of the big pharmaceutical companies. That's what should be happening. But taking money out of the market at the final dollar level, that is not going to work, because at the end of the day, if you look at a lot of the drugs that are developed, that's even $2-3 billion blockbuster drugs, or through $200 million drugs, there's not a huge amount of margin there. You really need to be able to get a sense of how big the market is. And I mean, the United States has the bulk to unilaterally negotiate drug prices if it wants to. The reality is that there's going to be less pharmaceutical research down the road.
All right, so Mark Carney visited the White House last week.
He seems to have done well. Yeah.
It appears that, and this seems to matter in terms of foreign policy interactions with Trump, that he likes Mark Carney.
I think he was pretty obvious.
It was pretty obvious he really, really, really did not like Justin Trudeau.
He really didn't like Chrystia Freeland. And I think there's a very specific reason for that, because Trump is kind of a little bit shy to say the real reason, is that Chrystia Freeland has been doing a lot of, what's the right word? Vigilante work on Ukraine. And Trump,
I don't know if I'd use that term, but...
It's outside the system is what that meant. It's kind of outside the formal system. And it's been there are reports coming out of Ottawa that Chrystia Freeland has been sort of under the table, being liaising with elements of quote unquote resistance left in the United States in order to outbid Trump, specifically on the Ukraine question, on the Ukraine issue. And that has been a great irritation, obviously, for the administration, because if that, there's one thing the administration is united on, you know, they're not united on anything, but if there is one thing they're united on, is that they want to retrench a little bit on Ukraine. And this has been a thorn on their side. So Trump will always talk about how, you know, Chrystia, she wasn't so nice in sort of USMCA, USMCA negotiations in his first term, but honestly, he never displayed any indication that he cared about this until 1 or 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he didn't like Trudeau because Trudeau mocked him at some point, you know, at international conferences. And that's just something you can't take back. That's unfortunate. And I don't think Justin Trudeau should have actually done that, because it was undiplomatic. But Chrystia Freeland, again, locked in, it was kind of a tough situation. I think she's probably going to remain in the cabinet tomorrow, because the new cabinet is going to be announced tomorrow. It's going to be a cabinet again with gender parity, which is great. But I think Trump has very specific reasons for disliking Freeland, and I think Mark Carney would be wise not to fight him on this, if to the extent that's possible and consistent with.
Well, I mean, already there's different ministers leading the trade portfolios.
I mean, she is definitely not going to be allowed to handle trade. She's handling transport. She's basically being stuck in a file drawer somewhere in like a corner.
Well,
of
we'll see where that comes, because of course that was you know, a move Trudeau made. So we'll see where that goes tomorrow. She's obviously one of their high profile people, but probably won't be put on the Trump front.
It's unlikely. But it's also, I think Mark Carney also wants to leave his own footprint on the key issues, and the key issues does involve Trump and trade.
Well, if I could just, even before he got elected, right when he got became prime minister, he went to Europe to get some sort of support.
Yeah.
And he was kind of criticized, but I think he did exactly the right thing. That's what he initially did. Now, I think the meeting with Donald Trump is kind of a lot of white noise in a sense, because
I agree.
Because the point is that he's establishing the ties globally. Mm-hmm. That's the more important thing. So what he did was he firmly said, look, I don't want us to join the United States. He firmly said that. And that was important to say. But a lot of, like, you can read a lot of whatever into it. But I think he did well, and he just firmly said that. And really, the thing is not so much dealing with Donald Trump as dealing with the whole rest of the world is basically how I think we're going to come through it, our country.
All right. Well, thanks for that, guys.
Pleasure.
We will be you guys will be back. Well, you'll be back next week, yeah?
I hope so.
Okay.
It's a holiday next week.
Probably the week after.
We're going to have to pre-record, and Magnus always wants to pretend it's live when it's a free recording.
Don't give up our secrets, Peter.
There's no secret. Okay. My goodness, my God.
Next up here, we have a report from Jesse Wensloff, our local journalism initiative reporter here at CJSF Radio, about Red Dress Day here at SFU.
The red dress, hanging from a window, a porch, or a doorway, is a powerful symbol and a reminder of the ongoing epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. Monday, May 5th, was Red Dress Day, and the National Day of Awareness and Remembrance for the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and 2SLGBTQI+ people. And red dresses hang throughout all three campuses of Simon Fraser University. At the entrance of the Burnaby campus's Student Union Building, a memorial display has been set up by SFU's Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, or SVSPO, and the Women's Center, giving students, staff, and community members the opportunity to remember, memorialize, and pay tribute. Konstantin Lazitsky, a staff member at Out on Campus, SFU's 2SLGBTQI+ student organization, attended the memorial.
I think it's a very powerful symbol of the red dress because it is so striking and so visual, and then it reminds you just seeing one or two, and then you start seeing more and more of them around campus, seeing them on different campuses, seeing them in the community, just to give you a tangible way to realize the scope of what is happening and how it isn't just, oh, somebody else's cousin or sibling is lost, or somebody else in the community that I'm not really connected to. All of those stories are real, but they may not connect to you on the same way as it is hundreds and thousands of people that should be here, that should be in community, that should be still doing everything they wish to do, but instead they're not here with us. And so I think it is a way to bring some sort of symbol of them back, to bring something that was taken away, that is no longer here, to bring the people who are important back into the communities where they matter. And so I think it is so important to see visible and proud declarations that this is a day to remember all of the folks that were taken and they're gone, and that we're hoping will one day be returned to their communities.
Paula Quilos-Cruz is an educator with the SVSPO and helped organize the memorial.
Today we are hosting awareness tables and memorials in the three different SFU campuses in Vancouver, Burnaby, and Surrey. We wanted to make sure that non-Indigenous people have a space where they can come and honor missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit folks, learn more about it, what actions they can take, to reflect also on their own commitment and how we can change this epidemic as well. And then to have a space to meet with other people and maybe do some coloring pages and some pins. Also bring offerings to the memorial table, or they can take one of the flowers that we have there and they can bring it back to the land or a park close to their home. Thinking about all those sisters and friends and grandmas and aunties and the daughter of someone and some other folks who are no longer here because of this colonial epidemic that is happening in Canada. The Red Dress started as a campaign many years ago that was entitled the Red Dress Project, and it was launched in 2014 by Métis artist Jamie Black. And what this artist wanted to do was to honoring all these women who are no longer here with one red dress. And so that is the symbolism of the red dress, the ones that are not here, but that again are present, and it should be in all our memories to remember that is not something that we need to forget.
Kilos Clues started by connecting with Indigenous-led organizations on campus.
It was very important first to consult with the staff from Indigenous Student Center, as we wanted to, of course, honor the Indigenous voices and how we could do this in a respectful way.
This consultation helped ensure the event was culturally appropriate, and the collaboration led to a display that is engaging and interactive.
I thought that having a memorial table is really important, just to pace yourself and stand in front of this table and reflect what is happening here, and also make the table interactive. So that's why we invite people to bring offerings like a leaf or a stone or anything that they wanted to bring to the table. But if they couldn't, then they will have the possibility to take something from the table and connect with the land, because we know that Indigenous folks are connected with the land, and then the land is also part of their lives. So as a way to kind of honoring both things.
Julia Lane is one of the many people who stopped by the memorial.
I am here because I think it's incredibly important on this day, but also all days, for us to remember and hold very close in our hearts the kin who we have in the larger human context of being related to one another, who have been stolen from us, whether that is being murdered or by being stolen and they are now what we would call missing Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit folks, and recognizing that that is a really horrifying, tragic, and violent part of ongoing colonization in these lands. I'm feeling... I came in feeling overwhelmed, so I'm feeling overwhelmed, but I'm also feeling really grateful to the folks who put it together and put it on as a place for us to hold those feelings of sadness and overwhelm together. And I'm feeling very grateful for the invitation that I was offered to take a rose and to bring the rose to the land, because it feels like an active thing that I can do and an opportunity to remember the women and the girls and the Two-Spirit people, and also hold beauty and remember that there is beauty in addition to all of the harm and the hurt and the sadness.
One of the activities at the memorial prompted visitors to take a piece of paper shaped like a dress and write down actions to help raise awareness and work towards ending the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. As Lane explains, it can be a daunting challenge.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough to think about what kinds of actions are helpful, because I feel like so often actions that we hear about or think about or talk about are just not enough, and I feel that. So yeah, I guess one of the things that I've been reflecting on recently is just like recognizing and naming the all the like really deeply insidious ways that violence is interconnected. Violence against so many folks, violence against women, and violence against the land. And so recognizing these intersections and these interconnections and naming them and calling them out and being really consistent about that so that we are able to challenge the more like insidious forms of this kinds of toxicity and violence when it comes up might be a way that we help to keep it from escalating into the really extreme forms of violence that also continue to happen.
Regardless of what suggestions might be made, Kilos Clues hopes that students and community members can take something hopeful and useful away from the memorial.
So just to reflect and learn more about the history of Canada, because there could be some students that maybe are just arriving, they don't know what happened before. So learn more about the history. They can hang a red dress in their window, or they can wear all this week red if they want. Also reading the final report from the National Inquiry of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls and see how they can work in one of those actions, and also as individuals, an invitation to reflect what as change makers, because we are all change makers in this community, they can do in order to bring more awareness or share this with family or talk with their partner, with their friend, and support different Indigenous initiatives here on campus and also outside of campus, challenge lots of biases and stereotypes towards Indigenous people. So there are so many ways that folks can create action towards this. It could be something small, something big, but at the end of the day, if we are actioning something, then we're making a difference.
For CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, on the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam and Squamish-speaking peoples, I'm Jesse Wentzloff. This report is made possible by support from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative and can be found online with stories from across the country at frequencynews.ca.
Halelulahelu is a local musician. She's been active on the scene for a few years now. Former CJSF volunteer, too. This is a track from one of her latest releases. This is Manic Pixie Pacifist.
Don't call me and expect anything other than my usual apathetic tone. I'm not a cop, I'm not a priest, but you'll confess it all to me. Knows. Maybe I'm just a manic pixie pacifist at the real of the life that you've been living in. Just a step in a character development. Was I just playing a role? What are you taking me home? We took the day to cry. I told you I'm afraid the change you went away. I pity the version of me who carved my name into that tree. I hate the way I left it. I took it away and let you walk. You say I'm manifested, but I know the path.
Halelulahelu and Manic Pixie Pacifist. Let's take a quick look at the weather here for the week ahead. I think we're going to have basically the whole week's going to be a lot like the weekend was. Next couple of days are a mix of sun and cloud with highs up to 16. By midweek, we're looking at cloudy with a bit of a cooling trend that starts to turn around on Saturday with a switch back to a mix of sun and cloud on Sunday with expectations of rain on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So I guess you need to keep your coat with you and maybe bring an umbrella just in case. And hopefully it's not going to be too bad. Next up, we have a look at the birds. This is Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. With white and gray feathers, a piercing stare, and noisy screams, the American herring gull is what most folks might call a seagull. But you're likely to see these gulls far from shore, too. The American herring gull is one of four nearly identical species found in temperate regions of the Northern Hemisphere, including the European herring gull, Vega gull, and Mongolian gull. In fact, ornithologists once lumped them all together under the single species name herring gull until 2024, when scientists found key differences in their genetics, appearance, and vocalizations. Just as